Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am privileged to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Maurice Carney, who is the executive director and a co-founder of Friends of the Congo. The website is friendsofthecongo.org. He has worked with Congolese for over 15 years. He is also in a film, a short film that you can watch online called Crisis in the Congo, which I highly recommend, and you can get there at congojustice.org. Maurice Carney, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
It's terrific to have you on. You have this website and this film that tell well over 100 years of summarized history of the Congo, as well as the background of the current crises. Maybe you could summarize for us, starting in 1885 or earlier, what is the story of this place?
Present-day Democratic Republic of the Congo is located in the heart of Africa. It actually straddles the equator and is bordered by 9 other African countries. No country of the 54 countries on the continent, African continent, has that many countries bordering it. So the Congo is a country and a region in and of itself. It's the size of Western Europe, has an estimated population of 70 million people, one of the largest countries in the world, and It is really the fulcrum in which the African continent swings. It's literally and figuratively the heart of Africa. And it's endowed with spectacular wealth, natural wealth, both precious and strategic minerals. And as a result of its enormous wealth, it has attracted a great deal of intrigue. Congo has a history, long history, before 1885, when we see the modern founding of the Congo at the Berlin Conference in Berlin, Germany, 1884-1885, was when European nations got together and established their spheres of influence on the African continent that we see reflected in the diversity of the countries on the continent today. Congo was at the center of that. During the conference, the spheres were established by different countries that subsequently fell under colonial rule. But Congo was unique in that the Berlin Conference was given to King Leopold II as his own personal property. He owned it outright, owned everything. And within a 23-year period from 1885 to 1908, he extracted an estimated $1 billion of rubber and ivory from the Congo. However, this was to the tremendous detriment of the population. The population was half during that 23-year period, where an estimated 10 to 15 million people, Congolese, lost their lives in the extraction of the natural resources and the brutal rule of the king. In fact, the rule was such that there was an international outcry. You had figures like Mark Twain. He wrote a piece called King Leopold's Soliloquy. Sir Conan Arthur Doyle, some of you listening audience may be familiar with him. He's known for Sherlock Holmes fame. He wrote Crime in the Congo. He had this international outcry against the brutal rule of King Leopold II of Belgium in the Congo. Hence, he had to turn the Congo over. Unfortunately, it wasn't turned over to the Congolese people. It was turned over to the Belgian state that ruled it as a colonial outpost from 1908 to 1960, where the extraction of natural resources continued. In addition to rubber and ivory, you now had gold and copper and tin and cobalt, and most famously, uranium. The uranium that was used in the atomic weapons that were dropped on Japan during World War II by the United States came from primarily from the Congo. So, from 1908 to 1960, Congolese were trying to gain control of their country and the affairs of the country. And they finally did that in 1960. They got their independence. They elected a democratically elected first prime minister by the name of Patrice Emery Lumumba. And he basically stood up and said to the world that we want to utilize this wealth that we have for the benefit of Congolese and for Africa in general. And this sent shuttles through the West, and it didn't sit well with Western powers like the United States, Belgium, and other European powers. So Lumumba was quickly overthrown by the CIA. This is recounted in a book by the main person responsible for the overthrow of Lumumba. His name is Larry Devlin. He was the CIA chief of station. So he wrote a book that documented how he went about overthrowing Lumumba, entitled Chief of Station, Congo.
So we also just had on this program an author named Stephen Kinzer, who has a new book called The Brothers, about the Dulles brothers, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, who told this story. So listeners to this program should be at least slightly familiar with the murder of Patrice Lumumba.
Right, and in fact, the United States State Department, within the past couple weeks or so, finally released the declassified documents of U.S. covert action in the Congo at that time, from 1960 to 1968. The documents had been declassified for about 20 years, but they just got published. So those declassified documents also go in to provide further detail around the U.S. role in the overthrow and subsequent assassination of Patrice.
And so he was assassinated in 1961, and then presumably the United States installed a wonderful, peaceful democracy from that point forward. Is that accurate?
Well, not a wonderful, peaceful democracy, in fact. And I get the sarcasm. They installed a brutal dictatorship, a gentleman by the name of Joseph Désiré Mobutu. And they installed him. Not only did they install him, but they also maintained him. He remained in power for over three decades, from 1965 to 1997, where he, as Adam Hochschild, the author of King Leopold's Ghost, said in our short film, he bled the country dry. He had Swiss bank accounts, accumulated billions of dollars, just looted the country, hardly developed any infrastructure as it relates to roads or health. It was a dictatorship that was maintained by the U.S. He visited just about every U.S. president from the 1960s right up to Reagan and Bush. When the United States got tired of Mobutu, the late 1990s, where we, the Cold War was over and it was they didn't necessarily have a need for him anymore. He was a strong ally during that period. Instead of turning the country over to the Congolese and letting the Congolese determine and control the affairs of the Congo, instead of supporting a nonviolent pro-democracy movement that had developed in the late 80s and early 1990s, the U.S. Reached out to its strongman allies in the region, primarily Rwanda and Uganda, and backed an invasion of the Congo in 1996. And that invasion and a subsequent invasion in 1998, and support of proxy militia groups inside of the Congo by U.S. allies Rwanda and Uganda triggered what the United Nations says is the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, where from 1996 to 2007, an estimated 6 million Congolese lost their lives as a result of the conflict and conflict-related causes. So that's the situation that really continues to this day, although it is abated somewhat. You have U.S. allies, Rwanda and Uganda, who have been supporting proxy militia inside of the Congo that have been destabilizing the country and causing a great deal of suffering. While this is going on, you also have the concomitant pilfering of the country by multinational corporations from around the world. Journals estimate, economists have estimated, there's approximately $24 trillion worth of natural wealth in the country. We don't know if that's true or not, but the fact that such an estimate is made gives you a sense of the type of wealth that's at stake. Congo is arguably the richest country on the planet. So you have the super exploitation of Congo's resources. Gold, copper, diamond, tin, you name it. It's both precious and strategic minerals. Many of these minerals are vital to various industries in the West, whether we're talking about the electronics industry or aerospace or military industry or automotive industry. Yeah, you have a mineral called coltan, short for columbide tantalite. Once it's refined and processed, it has two main characteristics. It retains electric charge, probably better than most minerals, and it's also heat resistant. And what this does is allow the coltan, which is transformed into capacitors, to be utilized in increasingly smaller devices while maintaining the same, or increasing actually, the power of those devices. So coltan is found in our cell phones, video games that our children play, our laptop computers, a whole host of electronic devices. It's said that every American has at least one device in which coltan is found. We've seen for the last 125 years a scramble for Congo's riches, whether it's rubber in the late 1800s and ivory, or coltan and cobalt today, at the dawn of the 21st century. The central aim of the Congolese people is to control that enormous wealth and utilize the wealth for the benefit of the people in particular inside of Congo and for Africa as a whole, especially considering the tremendous wealth that's in the Congo.
Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo. We're walking around then with something dug up in the Congo in all of our pockets, in our cell phones and our other gadgets, but we seem to, in general, know very, very little about the Congo. How is it that we've all heard about the genocide in Rwanda in the 1990s, although perhaps not the background of what caused it, but the subsequent genocide in the Congo, most people seem to know very little about?
It's, there's several reasons, for this. One, of course, it's we're talking about Africa and African lives being lost. African lives, as a matter of history, are not as valued as other lives. And when we hear of conflict in Africa, we think that as a normal course, part of what happens naturally in Africa, so we're less apt to pay attention to what's going on, especially in the heart of Africa. Also, the Congo conflict is drawn out. It's slow. It wasn't as dramatic as the Rwanda genocide, so the lack of drama also plays a role. In addition to that, some of the main instigators of the conflict itself and the tremendous loss of life are U.S. allies. People that the United States and leaders of the United States, Bill Clinton in particular, call the Renaissance leaders of Africa, the new leaders of Africa. And they're presented to the world as being, virtuous, upright, and the epitome of good leadership on the African continent. We're talking about primarily Paul Kagame of Rwanda, the president, the current president, and Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, the current president. Both of those leaders invaded the Congo twice, support proxy militia inside of the Congo, and have caused tremendous suffering. And the crimes that they've committed locally, those crimes have been cleansed at the international level by the United States and the United Kingdom in particular. Both countries have run interference at the level of the United Nations, where studies have been blocked or implementation or recommendations coming out of studies that document gross atrocities that have been committed. Both the United States and the United Kingdom have worked over the last 17 years to assure that either the studies are not published or little to no action taken on them. So those are some of the reasons why, main reasons why we know very little about what the United Nations said is the deadliest conflict in the world since the Holocaust.
Earlier this month, Bishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa wrote in the New York Times op-ed section that African leaders must support the International Criminal Court. And we had a guest on this program, Ed Herman, who argued that, in fact, the International Criminal Court has only been prosecuting Africans and only those Africans not working closely with the U.S. government. So it's not a force for justice, although perhaps transformed, it could be. What is your take on that debate?
Well, interestingly enough, the first four individuals tried and or brought to the International Criminal Court are Congolese. And the first person tried, Thomas Lubanga, is a Congolese. the rebel leader. So the cases that are at the ICC, International Criminal Court, and the first case with Lubanga, points out the weakness of the International Criminal Court, because Lubanga, for example, is a rebel leader inside of the Congo. You know, he's been made to account. However, his sponsors, U.S. allies, Paul Kagame, Yoweri Museveni, are left to go free. That's an indication of the weakness of the International Criminal Court. As we've seen, it's been utilized to focus primarily on Africans. Surely a number of people have argued that what has happened with the invasion of Iraq by the United States, both Dick Cheney and George Bush himself, could be presented to the court. We look at what's the gentleman's name in the Nixon administration?
Kissinger?
Henry Kissinger. And I know some European countries, I don't think he can travel there because they're looking to bring him to bear for some of the crimes he's involved in as a result of the policies that he supported. Of course, it was before the International Criminal Court, but you have principle of universal jurisdiction that Spain uses, for example, in indicting Pinochet of Chile. And as you know, and your listening audience probably know, Kissinger was a major player in the overthrow of Allende and the imposition, installation, and maintenance of Pinochet. So it's even before the court, the International Criminal Court, the justice has been uneven. Now some of these leaders on the African continent need to be held to account, but they're certainly not the only ones.
And they're not Kagame, and they're not the U.S. allies.
Exactly.
There also is, as you've discussed in your film and on your website, when Barack Obama was a senator, he put through a bill that was signed into law by President Bush that allowed action to be taken against countries like Rwanda and Uganda in defense of the Congo. Can you describe that law and what's become of it?
Sure. It's law, as you stated, was the bill was passed into law in December of 2006, and it's called the Democratic Republic of the Congo Relief, Security, and Democracy Promotion Act. And it has a number of elements, but one key element is a section in there called Section 105 that authorizes the Secretary of State to withhold aid from neighboring countries that destabilize the Congo. And this law has been on the books, but it had not been implemented, at least not until 2012. You know, from the Bush administration through the first Obama administration, no action had been taken, even though, you know, President Obama was the sponsor of the law and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, was a co-sponsor. They did not take any action, even as the conflict in the Congo continued unabated. But it was not until 2012, after a great deal of pressure that came from advocacy groups such as Friends of the Congo, came from the media. A number of media outlets started covering the issue and asking, keener questions. You had a situation where a Rwanda-backed group inside of the Congo had occupied city in the east of the country called Goma of 1 million people, right in the midst of estimated 18,000 UN peacekeepers, which embarrassed the United Nations. Also, you had reports coming out of the UN by their group of experts that documented unequivocally the support that Rwanda was providing to the militia group. Not only support, but the direction, the arming, the controlling of the group, the provision of soldiers, you name it. As well documented, and the United States that had credible evidence that this was happening. The report wasn't much different from the other reports that have been published since 1997. But because of the increased awareness, because of the media shining light on the situation, the United States had to act, and they finally, in the summer of 2012, withheld a little bit of aid, $200,000 out of $200 million that Rwanda gets from the United States annually. And this served as the first time that the U.S. had done anything like this. And help to trigger similar actions among European nations like Great Britain, Germany, and Sweden, Netherlands, and a number of other European nations. And even in 2013, we saw that the U.S. Put Rwanda on the sanctions list for supporting groups inside of the Congo that recruit child soldiers. So there has been limited action, but when you on the part of the Obama administration on this law in his second term. However, when you match the scale of the tragedy, we're talking about millions of people who have lost their lives, estimated 6 million at least, half of those are children under the age of 5, hundreds of thousands of women systematically raped, arguably the greatest humanitarian crisis at the dawn of the 21st century, and the deadliest in the world, according to the United Nations since World War II. When you match that up against the action that have been taken by the administration with a law that's on the books, it has paled in comparison. So, and that's why we, are doing shows like yours. We're touring the country and educating Americans about this law, about the actions that they can take. Disparity in action on the part of the administration compared to the crisis that has occurred during the administration. And so we've been doing that, throughout the country. And it's important for Americans to understand that whether we know it or not, U.S. foreign policy has a role to play in the region. We're not asking the United States to get more involved in Congo or get involved at all. They're already involved. We're basically asking the U.S. to stop doing certain things, like stop arming, stop financing, stop training, stop running political and diplomatic interference at the international level on behalf of its allies in the region that are our main instigators of the conflict and of the suffering of the Congolese people.
People hear about these wars far away in distant places, and they imagine it's a function of the backwardness of those foreign people there. It's an ethnic dispute. But you argue that, in fact, it's largely the influence of our government and other governments pushing the wrong policies, and that, in fact, people in wealthy nations could be buying those minerals and those natural resources from the Congo without paying vast fortunes for the military expense that it takes to kill them. Is there an alternative approach here?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's not just a question of pushing wrong policies, but it's also a question of supporting strong men, supporting the people who are doing the killing, like actively supporting them, actively training them, actively arming them, actively financing them. You know, President Obama, in his last two times to the African continent, he gave speeches, and a consistent theme in the speeches was that the U.S. will no longer support strong men on the African continent, but will support strong institutions. So we've called on him to adhere to his own words and start supporting strong institutions as opposed to supporting strong men. So that is one alternative, because often the United States is a difference maker. If it tips its hat or provide support to a strong man, that strong man can hold an entire nation of tens of millions of people hostage. So that's one alternative for the U.S. to support strong institutions as opposed to supporting strong men. For the U.S. to prioritize the people or over prioritizing corporate interests. For the U.S. To cease its intervention in a destructive way in the Congo in particular and other African nations. But you have movements on the ground that are fighting for change, that are fighting for peace, that are fighting for social justice and human dignity, control of their own affairs. However, these movements not only have to go up against their own elite, but they have to go up against the backing that these elites receive from the U.S. And that only these elites do not only receive support from U.S. government, but they're highly placed, highly influential individuals in the West, such as former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Tony Blair, a strong supporter of Rwanda's President Paul Kagame. You have Howard G. Buffett Jr., the son of Warren, billionaire Warren Buffett, a strong supporter of Paul Kagame. You have former President Bill Clinton, another strong supporter of Paul Kagame. So you have figures in the West, Rick Warren, know, the pastor, the purpose-driven life out there in California, a strong supporter of Paul Kagame. So you have both the government and influential individuals in the West that support these mass killings. So what we like for them to do is to stop. You know, left to their own devices, the people would, on the ground, in the Congo and in the region, overwhelmingly are peace-loving people who, if left to their own devices, would put in place leaders that would represent their interests, as opposed to leaders that are in place that represent the interests of foreign powers like the United States Kingdom and foreign capital multinational corporations like we currently have.
The 6 million estimated dead in the past 17 years, is that level of killing ongoing? What is the level of suffering right now?
Well, the level of suffering is ongoing. We haven't had a mortality study since 2007, so we don't know the actual numbers. But we, since, for example, we do know that millions of people, I think 2 million, is displaced. Since the last uprising in 2012, in the east of the country, you had up to 800,000 that were internally displaced along as a result of that. You have women being consistently raped, children being recruited as child soldiers. So this is acute suffering that, in addition to the abject poverty that exists in the country itself, the United Nations has a report that it published each year and called it the Development Index report. And the Congo is, for the last 2 years, that these have been 187 out of 187 countries. Or 186 out of 187 countries, not a Human Development Index. So that gives you a sense of the level of poverty. And the per capita income is, you know, just a little bit over $200 a year. So there's just tremendous pain and unnecessary suffering that is taking place.
We've been speaking with Maurice Carney, who is the executive director of Friends of the Congo. You can go to friendsofthecongo.org to learn more. And do not hesitate to tell your government to stop shipping weapons over there, stop training soldiers, and make this a better country just by refraining from what is now being done. Maurice Carney, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, and we encourage your listeners to go to congojustice.org and watch the film. It's free. They can download it. And if they wish, they can have screenings in their communities and invite us in. If they can't bring us in, they can Skype us. Personally, they can Skype us. So we highly recommend it. Highly recommend the film at congojustice.org. It's free, easy to download, and then we can even send DVDs if people are not as adept online. So thank you very much for the opportunity. Really enjoying speaking with you today.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.